Welcome to the weekly Dharma Talk podcast from the Columbus Karmateksum Choling Buddhist Meditation Center. This week's talk, given by Lama Kathy Wesley, is entitled Going with the Flow of Blessings, the Buddhist New Year and Calendar. The Buddha's teachings on interdependence tell us that everything in our world is interconnected, people, things, and so on. While this is merely relative truth, while the ultimate truth of wisdom and limitlessness remains hidden from us, we can use our understanding of relative truth to go with the energy of the day and make progress in our path. If you like our Dharma Talk series, please consider donating to Columbus Karmateksum Choling at columbusktc.org. Enjoy the podcast.
Hello, everybody. Thanks for coming. I appreciate you coming to spend some time with us today. And today I'm going to be talking a little bit about the upcoming week and what we're going to be experiencing as we get closer to the Tibetan New Year holiday. And we'll also talk a little bit about interdependence, which is one of the basic teachings of the Buddha, of all things being interdependent. And so we'll talk about interdependence and a little bit about the two truths, relative truth and ultimate truth, and how all of that affects us in our everyday, day-to-day life. Because most folks have very busy lives, and they don't have a lot of time to sit and reflect upon the Buddhist teachings. They just don't have a lot of time. We have to work so hard to make a living that it's not easy to reflect on the Buddha's teachings. So I figured that maybe today we'll reflect a little bit on relative truth, ultimate truth, and interdependence as we try to find ways to make relative truth and interdependence work in our favor while we're trying to practice the Buddha way. So everybody has one of these prayer sheets in front of you. We're going to start with an English recitation of refuge, and we'll be reciting that three times in English. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. In the Buddha, the Dharma, and the assembly most excellent, I take refuge until I reach enlightenment. By the merit of generosity and other good deeds, may I achieve enlightenment for the sake of all beings. Okay, thank you. And then I have a short prayer that I will recite, and then we'll be able to get started. Dunya may be dewa da ba da me drawa jerchi, nerin chantan tandre tayen chen pola ne pa jerchi. O palen sawe lam hadren boche, dagi chi war pede de shala. Kadren chen bukane chesun te, kusun tugging a drip saldus. Okay, thank you. Thanks again, everybody, for being here. When I first started studying the Buddha's teachings a long time ago, my big concern was not understanding all of the depths of Buddhist philosophy. My interest was getting some perspective on my day-to-day problems and my day-to-day life. When I first started practicing, it was all about pragmatism. I was being very practical, not what is the Buddhist worldview or what is the Buddhist view about this or that. I was mostly concerned with trying to get through my day without losing my temper too many times or without going to pieces because of something disappointing that happened. So when I started practicing Buddhism, I was mostly interested in the Buddha's teachings on calm abiding or shamatha. And therefore, the first thing I did was learn how to practice meditation. There are lots of different forms of meditation taught in Buddhist centers around the world, but to me, the one that seems to resonate the most for the most people is quiet sitting meditation. Quiet sitting meditation helps people in so many ways. And it's very exciting to know these days that even non-Buddhist people are interested in learning meditation because they feel it will help them with their everyday life. So I think that a lot of people are like I was back in the day. They are looking for the pragmatic application of the Buddhist teachings. The practice of quiet sitting meditation is deceptively simple. You place your body in a position of relative ease and comfort, sitting straight in your chair or on your seat on the floor, and following with your attention the breath, the course of the breath as it comes in and the course of the breath as it goes out. Very simple to do just this one thing. Mentally follow with your intention the breath in and out. Now, even though it's deceptively simple, the reason I say deceptively is because the technique is pretty simple. Follow the breath in, follow the breath out. But our attention cannot stay on it forever. Our attention tends to drift one way or the other. We'll drift into the future and start worrying about something that's coming tomorrow, or we'll start going into the past and start ruminating about something we said or did or somebody else said or did yesterday. So the pragmatist in me, when I was first learning how to meditate, was to figure out how following the breath could help me with my anger problem. How does following the breath do anything except make me more angry? Because I can't follow the technique or I can't do it satisfactorily enough. But lucky for me, I had good meditation teachers who were able to say that it is okay for you to get distracted while you're sitting and practicing meditation, as long as you are able to bring your attention back to the breath for a fresh start. And so this helped my pragmatic desire to learn about how to work with my day-to-day emotions. Because all of those day-to-day worries and concerns that we have, they're all made of thoughts. When we think about things perhaps too much and place our attention on things too strongly, we become worried or fixated upon them. And then this itself can lead to more pain and suffering, more anxiety and more concern. So the very technique of noticing a thought has distracted you and then touching that thought, letting it go and returning your attention to the breath for a fresh start, just that simple action of noticing, letting go and returning, doing that over and over and over again, gives us a little bit of a practical way of working with our thoughts and mind. Just this week, I was teaching a small group at a Lutheran church how to meditate. And one of the men said, I said, how has your week gone with meditation? Has meditation helped you at all this week? And one gentleman said, well, yes, I have to say that I was really getting impatient with someone and was about to open my mouth and say something very cruel when I realized that maybe the best thing for me to do is to take a breath and follow that breath. And just take that breath again and again until the feeling of anger and impatience passes. He said, is that a good way to use meditation? And I said, absolutely. So most of the people in this room can relate to this, that perhaps you've been in the middle of a situation where you're about to lose your temper, lose your cool, and you're able to think, wait a minute, I don't need to do this, and then follow your breath in and out for just a little while. I guess you could say it's the Buddhist equivalent of closing your mouth and counting to 10 before you say anything. This is what our grandparents used to say. Before you open your mouth, if you're angry, count to 10 and then say something. Although most of us usually use that 10 count to get more angry. But still, let's not worry about that right now. So this is a little bit about how the relative pragmatic aspects of Buddhism can help us in our everyday life by learning how to place our attention on the breath and to replace our attention when it wanders. Just that simple pragmatic step can help us when we're not meditating in our everyday life. And the same is true for compassion meditation, the second kind of meditation we teach here. Compassion meditation, you think that as you breathe out, that you give goodness to the world. And then as you breathe in, you think you remove suffering from the world. And that when that suffering comes to you, it meets with your pure motivation to benefit beings, and all of that suffering dissolves into nothing and disappears. And then with the next out breath, you give goodness to the world, breathe in, remove their suffering of the world. Then it meets your pure motivation, dissolves into nothing, that suffering dissolves into nothing and disappears, and so on. So by doing compassion meditation over and over again, what we're doing is we're exercising our love and we're exercising our compassion. Now, most people can agree that workouts are good for you. Most workouts are good for most people. Although I am not as good at working out as I used to be, which is anyway, it's just a habit that I haven't really taken hold of. Let's put it this way. But working out with your love and compassion, according to the teachings of the Buddha, is a good way to train your mind to have a different response when something happens. If you're training on wishing happiness for others with that out breath, and you're training in removing suffering from others on that in breath, if you're busy training in that way, then when something happens and you begin to lose your temper, you have another place to go. You can think that you send goodness to all the people who are making the problems for you that you get angry about. And as you breathe in, you can remove all of their anger and difficulty. And then by doing that, that's another pragmatic method of using the Buddhist teachings to our own advantage. And the third kind of meditation we teach here is mantra meditation. I guess you could call mantra meditation healthy and pragmatic from the point of view that sometimes we need a replacement thought. We don't need to get rid of a thought. We just need another thought to replace it. For example, if we are worried about something, that's not a healthy thought for us, because sometimes even worry can make you sick. So we have to find a thought to replace the thought of worry with. And so the Buddhist teachings teach us that by reciting the names of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, that by reciting their names out loud, we place a different thought in our mind purposefully. We purposefully take the negative thoughts that we have and place in their place something positive and virtuous. So by saying the Chenrezig mantra, the compassion mantra, Om Mani Padme Hung, by saying Om Mani Padme Hung, we change the thought that's in our mind with a new thought, the thought of the name of the compassion bodhisattva Chenrezig. So by doing that, we use a replacement thought that is in some ways very close to our own true nature, because the Buddha taught that each of us has the potential to become Buddha ourselves. All of us have Buddha nature. And so in order to nurture and to cultivate our Buddha nature, we need to be able to practice. And so one of the easiest ways to practice is by reciting the names of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. And mantras are essentially short and long versions of the names of Buddhas and Bodhisattvas. So that's a little bit about the three methods of meditation we teach here and how they can be used pragmatically to change our experience of everyday life. Now, I also wanted to talk a little bit today about interdependence. The Buddha said that all things in this world are interdependent. He said that when we do think and say things, it makes an impact on us. When we think something, when we say something, and when we do something, it makes an impact upon us. And that impact, you could say, is a form of karma. And this karma, or action, makes an impression on us, and it turns us into something slowly and gradually over time. So if we spend our lives being worried and upset, then it changes us into a worrier. If we spend our lives being angry about things, it turns us into an angry person, and so on. So pragmatically, we have some benefit if we change our way of thinking and change the things that we do. But then also things in the world are interdependent. Nothing exists of itself and by itself, but that it exists in relationship to other things. This is something that the native cultures of the world have known for a very long time. In fact, in native culture, there's a lot of spiritual energy put into the environment, where the people in traditional cultures pray for the environment. They interact with the environment in the healthiest way they can think of. When they take something from the environment, they give something else back, and so on. So in this way, they use what we call relative truth in order to bring about a state of balance for themselves and for the world. And so in so doing, these prayers and practices, the traditional people of the world put back into the world something positive that then the world contains and holds and then is present for the next person. So it's, I guess you could say that that phrase that we've used over a number of years, paying it forward. When something good happens to us, we try to put something good into the environment to pay forward the goodness that we brought from the world. So you could say that because everything is interdependent and everything is connected, then when we put something good into the world, then that helps the world. And when we put something negative into the world, that hurts the world. So we have to try to make our outputs more positive than negative. And this is another way that interdependence can work in our favor, because the Buddha in his teaching said, we are what we think, all that we are arises with our thoughts, and with our thoughts we make the world. So if that's the case, then the things we hold on our mind impact what we actually experience. If we're in a good mood, then everything that happens to us actually just adds to our good mood. But if we're in a bad mood, everything that happens to us just adds to our bad attitude. So we have choices, in other words, to put positive things into our world and to do our best to heal negative things in the world. And this is why I'm talking today about interdependence, because we have an opportunity to put goodness into our world every day. We have the potential to put goodness into our world every day with our meditation practice. Our meditation practice makes us calmer. It makes us more at peace with ourselves. It makes us more attentive and constructive in our thinking and in our interrelationships with other people. It improves our relationships with ourselves and with others. And so in that way, we are putting something positive into the world whenever we sit down and meditate. We're putting something positive in the world when we sit down and recite Om Mani Padme Hum or any of the other mantras. We're putting something positive into our world when we do compassion meditation, even though, as one of my lamas observed, just thinking about compassion doesn't make the world a more compassionate place, but it will make you more compassionate, and the world around you will become more compassionate, and hopefully that will grow and affect others. Now, you might ask, well, what does interdependence and putting out good energy into the world, what does that have to do with the observance of Tibetan holidays like the New Year? Well, that's a good question. And it's something that we'll be answering as the week progresses. It is said that the Buddhist calendar is a reflection of the events that happened in the life of the Buddha. And it is said that the lunar calendar that the Tibetans use to guide their calendars is based upon the Buddha's life. The Buddha, when he was alive, performed 12 great deeds. And those 12 great deeds are spoken of in the prayer called the 12 Deeds of the Buddha. And we'll be reciting this prayer in a couple of weeks' time when we celebrate Losar. And the reason we recite the prayer is because we want to make a connection in our own mind, a conscious connection between ourselves and the Buddha Shakyamuni and the events of his life. And in fact, the new year is timed to coincide with what is called the waxing moon of miracles. Every lunar month is divided into two parts. The waxing moon, as the moon goes from a little sliver and gets larger and appears to be larger and larger in the sky until it is full. The full disk of the moon is seen on the 15th day of the lunar month. That's the waxing moon from the first day of the lunar month to the 15th day of the lunar month. And then the waning moon is when it goes from that big silver disk down to a small crescent on the last day of the moon, before a new moon, when the moon appears to disappear completely. And that is the 30th day of the lunar month. And so by dividing the calendar into waxing and waning moons, the Tibetans and other cultures, traditional cultures, give us a way to work with the relative truth of the world. Just as a person would not like to go outside purposefully without a coat on a cold day, or purposefully without a coat on a downpour, a rainy day, therefore, we try to do things in our virtuous life that work with the world rather than against it. So if we are working with the waxing moon by doing virtuous things during that time, our virtue will increase. And this is one of the things that we can think about at the beginning of the Buddhist New Year, because the first 15 days talk about the first 15 days of a waxing moon. Many, many centuries ago, when the Buddha performed a miracle every day in order to put goodness into his world and to convince those who were skeptical of his teachings that his teachings had value. In those days, it was common for the great philosophers of the days to hold debates. And they would debate one another, and the stakes were high. Because if you lost the debate, all of your followers would have to convert to the way of thinking of the victor of that philosophical debate. Can't imagine that these days, but that's what they did. I know. Can't imagine that these days, but that's what they did then. And so the stakes were very high for the Buddha Shakyamuni. If he lost this debate with the non-Buddhist scholars, all of his followers would have to convert to the other scholars' method of thinking and belief system. So he decided to win decisively, and by performing a miracle every day for 15 days, he was able to convince the skeptics that whether his philosophy made sense to them or not, it had a great deal of spiritual validity and power. And so this is what is commemorated by the first 15 days of the Tibetan Lunar New Year, and this is why it's recommended that we increase our practice during that time. Now, of course, you could be on the other side saying that we probably need to increase our practice more during the waning moon of the month, because that is when energy is getting less and less and less and less. But I'd say if we asked a Buddhist teacher when it is better to practice during the waxing moon or the waning moon, that Buddhist teacher would say, practice every single day. So I have a feeling that their answer will always be the same, practice, practice, practice. So in this way, but it's great when we can put our little drop of virtue into the vast ocean. Because when we put the little drop of our everyday meditation practice into the vast ocean of virtue in the world, it's going to last for a long time. That virtue will last for a long time. Just as that one drop of water, if you hold it in the palm of your hand, that little drop of water might evaporate in a few minutes' time. But if you put that drop of water into the ocean, it's going to take a lot longer to evaporate. This example of the drop of water in the hand and the ocean is a classic Buddhist way of talking about the benefits of putting your virtue to good use by putting it in with the virtue of all of the awakened ones. So that's a little bit about the calendar and why we observe the special days of the Buddha. We observe the special days of the Buddha to align our intentions with the intentions of the Buddha in order to bring and cultivate and nurture our own Buddha nature and to cultivate and nurture our own Buddha nature toward awakening. And so this is one way in which we can use this relative truth of the world's appearance in order to help us. As you know, the Buddha taught two truths: the relative truth, which is how things appear, and the absolute truth or the ultimate truth, which is how things really are. How things appear may be illusory, but we have to work with them. How things really are may seem so subtle. The idea that everything is empty of solidity and full of wisdom and so on, that may be a very hard concept for us to grasp, but being able to work with the relative truth of virtue and goodness, that's something we can grasp right now and practice right now. And so that is why the calendar is arranged the way it is. Every few months, there is a special practice day devoted to one of the four great events of the 12. There are 12 deeds of the Buddha that are talked about in the prayer, but four among those are considered the greatest, and these come throughout the year. One is the Buddha's performance of miracles, which is celebrated at the Tibetan New Year. The second one is the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and death, which is celebrated at what's called Sagadawa, which is in May or June every year. It's usually called the celebration of the Buddha's enlightenment, but it actually contains all three of those events: his enlightenment, his birth, his enlightenment, and his passing away. And then the third of these holidays during the year is in the summertime, and it's the commemoration of the Buddha's first turning of the wheel of Dharma and teach his very first teaching as the enlightened one. And then finally, Labab Duchen, which is in the fall of the year, observes the miracle that he performed when the Buddha went to the heavenly realm and gave teachings to all of the gods and then decided that the humans still needed him and he needed to return to Earth. So these four commemorations, the Buddha's miracles, the Buddha's birth, enlightenment, and death, the Buddha's first teaching, and the Buddha's descent from the pure realm, all of these help us to understand the rhythm of the Buddha's life and the rhythm of the Buddha's life as it is echoed in our own life. Because it is said that each one of us, because we have Buddha nature, will someday lead the life of the Buddha. We will be born in good circumstances. We will leave behind worldly life in some way, shape, or form. We will practice meditation. We will gain enlightenment. We will teach, and we will pass away, just as the Buddha did. And someday this will happen for us. And this is how we slowly get there, by, I guess you could say, by treading in the footsteps of the Buddha. Anyone who has gone to and learned a folk dance will know how this works. If you've ever attended a folk dance, what you'll see is a group of people in the center, in the circle of the dance, doing the dance. And then you'll see a second group of individuals standing outside the main circle, practicing their steps in mirroring the people in the main circle who are dancing. So you could say that we're all learning our steps, so that when we become awakened beings, we can enact the same enlightened activity as the Buddha. And so this is just a little bit about why these special holidays are observed. What you will see here is that on the 24th of February, which is the first day of Tibetan New Year, here in this room, we'll be reciting in the morning. That's a Monday. You can tell your boss that you have to go to church, and that it's a holy day. It's not a holy day of obligation like the Catholics have, but it's a good one. And you can come and practice with us before you go to work. We'll be starting, I think it's at 8:30, if I remember correctly, and then we'll be here until about 9:30. So come down and practice with us and recite mantras with us in the morning. And that's on the 24th. And then on the 29th, I'm going to be doing a program on the taking of refuge. And this is where people take the Buddha as their teacher, the Dharma as their path, and the Sangha as their community. It's the entry ceremony for Buddhists. I'm going to be giving about an hour teaching on it at 10 o'clock in the morning on that Saturday, the 29th. And then after a short break, I'll be doing the ceremony, and people are welcome to attend. You can register online and attend. And then the following day is March the 1st. And March the 1st is the first Sunday in Losar when we have our Losar party here at the KTC. We're going to be commemorating the Tibetan New Year by making traditional Tibetan offerings. You will see kosher versions, 100% kosher versions of bread and everything else displayed here in the front. And we'll be doing the Tibetan ceremony of tossing grain into the air and wishing auspiciousness for the new year. And then we'll also be, I'll be giving out little amulets and things that you can keep as a memento of the new year. And then that particular day in the afternoon, I'll be doing the ceremony of giving the Bodhisattva vow for those who are interested. I'll be teaching on the Bodhisattva in my Dharma talk that day. But it's going to be a little abbreviated. I may have to start the lecture next week. And then in the afternoon, people who have already taken refuge and have practiced Dharma can take the Bodhisattva vow and make the vow that they will train in love and compassion as the Buddhists of the past have done. Training, taking a vow of training is not saying that you're going to be perfect today. It's saying that you will be willing to train as the Buddhas of the past did to work with their negative mental afflictions and accomplish goodness. So that's the talk for today. Just to talk a little bit about relative truth, ultimate truth, interdependence, why we observe the holidays with the life of the Buddha, how we can put virtue into the world every day with the three types of meditation practice. Quiet sitting puts virtue into the world. Mantra recitation puts goodness into the world. And compassion meditation puts goodness into the world. And how one of the things we can do as we're taking our steps to becoming a Buddha is bringing more virtue into our lives and into the lives of everyone around us. And all of that comes back to the pragmatic aspects of Dharma. Dharma is not just a philosophy or a worldview. It's about becoming a better version of ourselves. By better, I mean calmer, more calm, more peaceful, more attentive, more awake, and so on. It's actually that we don't change. Our sense of humor usually remains the same. As one Lama said, if you lose your sense of humor when you practice Dharma, you're doing it wrong. So in any case, if we can do our best to put some goodness in the world, that is our pragmatic way of putting the Buddha's teachings to work. So next week, I believe I'm teaching next week. I believe so. And if so, I'll be talking about the Bodhisattva vow. I'll give the first part of a two-part talk on it. And that way, if you miss the first part, you can listen to it online. So now, because we have some time, I thought it would be good for us to have discussion. You can either ask a question about the topic, or you can ask something that is just in your mind that you've always wanted to know about Dharma. So we have the question microphone here that is open and on for you. Thank you, Joseph. And so if anybody has a comment or a question or whatever, you can bring it to the microphone and we'll talk about it. Okay. By the way, I've been thinking about doing a Dharma talk called The Doctor Is In. And it would be mostly, we'd be doing a little meditation and then we would do Q&A on meditation. Diagnose your meditation and figure out what to do next.
That would make you Lama Lucy.
Hello. Yes, thank you.
Okay, this question is about Tushita Heaven. You mentioned that Shakyamuni Buddha taught there before it came to Earth. And then I'd heard Kenpo Rinpoche say once that the gods, they're basically just having too much fun and playing around to take much interest in Dharma. And I'd never, you know, and of course being in the god realm doesn't usually end very well. So I'd never, from that point, decided, you know, I wanted to go there. But I was always confused. I don't understand why sometimes there's reference to beings going to a heavenly realm. And are there god realms where there is Dharma? I mean, Shakyamuni was teaching, for example. Could you give me some perspective about that?
Yeah, sure. No, yeah, I appreciate you asking about this. Because it's both an easy question and a hard question, but let me try. When we talk about the relative truth, we're talking about the illusions we experience because we're confused about our Buddha nature, basically. We don't experience our Buddha nature as Buddha nature. We experience our Buddha nature as all of the thoughts that we have day to day to day. And on different days, different thoughts might predominate. When Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche talked about this in his book, Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, he explained the teaching that the Buddha gave called the six realms of existence as being psychophysical states that we as human beings engage in or experience on a daily basis. Some days we feel like we're just really suffering with no interruption. Some days we feel like we're suffering completely and thoroughly. And it's almost like we feel like we're in hell. And so that would be the experience of the hell realm, where it's just uninterrupted and difficult suffering. Then there might be other days when the emotion that predominates is an emotion of not being able to be satisfied, being completely unsatisfied by anything and wanting things we cannot have. Then this is the experience of the hungry ghost that is not able to eat and is always hungry. So that's our time in the hungry ghost realm. The animal realm is said to be the experience of complete dullness and ignorance. Whether you're a human being or an animal, you can experience the animal realm in your day-to-day existence when the predominating emotion in your mind is ignorance or bewilderment. Then there's the experience of the what they call the jealous god realm, which is where beings want what others have. They're envious or jealous of others and fight all the time to get what they think they deserve. And then finally, the god realm is those who have great resources, but they don't have much compassion, and they spend all of their time just whiling away the hours enjoying themselves, and that's the god realm. So in this way, Trungpa said, we all have these emotions. We have these all of the emotions that bring about these experiences. We have anger, which brings about hell. We have miserliness, which brings about the hungry ghost realm. We have the ignorance that brings about the animal existence. And the human realm, by the way, is the next one up from the animals. And you know what they say the emotion is that brings that about? A compulsive attachment. Surprise! Being a human being is about being compulsively attached to just about everything and thinking you have to have it in order to have a good life. Then the jealous god realm, that jealousy brings that about. And then pride and arrogance brings about the experience of the gods. So whether you think of these places as actual locations or whether you think of these places as being psychophysical states that we experience because of predominating emotions. Either way, it can be not very much fun. And the teachings given about these do indeed talk about there are places where gods are interested in Dharma and places where gods are not interested in Dharma, just as in the human realm. As you can see, how many people are interested in Dharma this morning versus how many people are not interested in Dharma this morning. It's a small group. So we'll have to ask Kempo Urgen Tenzin if there is just one experience in the god realm and that there are different individuals among the gods. That would be a great scholar question to ask him because he's studied all the scriptures in depth. I just know them well. I just know the teachings on the commentaries well enough to know that there are gods who are interested in Dharma and there are gods who are disinterested in Dharma, just as there are human beings interested in Dharma and human beings that are disinterested in Dharma. So we can be happy that we are one of those that are interested. So the Buddha went to talk to the interested parties in what was called the realm of the 33 gods, where his mother had been reborn after her death. He went to repay his mother's kindness, and in so doing to give them the means of practicing toward awakening. And so now we'll have to ask the scholars whether it's possible for the gods to become Buddhas or if they have to become human again first. I would be interested to know the answer to that question.
Okay.
But there also are, the God realm is in samsara. It's in samsara. But then the pure realm, the realm that is manifested by an awakened being after his or her enlightenment, that's a different experience. And you have to have reached a certain level of the bodhisattva awakening to even enter those realms, with the exception of Dewachen, because the Buddha Amitabha, who manifested the pure realm of Dewachen, basically set a low barrier. We can all get into it just by making the aspiration to be reborn there. We will call it a low barrier shelter from samsara.
I don't know if this is a fair question, but in general, in teachings, if there's reference to someone being reborn in a heavenly realm, can I always assume that's a god realm, or would that sometimes refer to it being a Buddha field?
For the most part, in the prayers I have read, so this means this doesn't cover 100% of prayers I have read, because I haven't read 100% of all Buddhist prayers. But in all the Buddhist prayers I have read, when we ask that for beings to be reborn in a pure realm or a heavenly realm, we're talking about Dewachen for the most part, or for the pure realms of other Buddhas, such as Abharati, which is Akshobhya's pure realm, Thirpu, which is Karmapa's pure realm, and so on.
Okay, thank you.
Okay. Other things to discuss? Comments, questions, thoughts? Yes, if you wouldn't mind using the microphone, sorry to make you do that. It's the, we can say it's aerobics, Dharma aerobics, but it's for the people who listen to the podcast.
Just in general, for people who are just learning about Buddhism, there is a way to get into the church, an oath to take, something of that nature, if you could just expand upon that.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for asking about this, because although we have a number of publications that people can read about the path, it's not everybody gets them, right? And so not everybody sees them. So I think it's a really good question to ask, so I'm glad you asked. Thank you. In the Buddha's teaching, it says that we have to do no harm, practice virtue, and tame our minds. That's the teaching of the Buddha. So doing no harm, practicing virtue, taming the mind, that's the teaching of the Buddha. But the various followers of the Buddha have used events in the Buddha's lifetime to fashion a path of beginning the Dharma, one's own Dharma path, and progressing in one's own Dharma path, and so on, based on events in the life of the Buddha. And so there is one of the 12 deeds of the Buddha where he enters the path of the Dharma to practice before he becomes the Buddha, when he's still Prince Siddhartha. He goes to the monument containing the relics of a Buddha from the past, and he symbolically leaves home and leaves behind his princely life by cutting off his top knot with in the movie Little Buddha. Keanu Reeves, who plays Prince Siddhartha, does this with a sword. We do not use swords in the hair cutting ceremony in our tradition, just so you know. It's an echo, the refuge, the taking of refuge ceremony that we do for people who are becoming Buddhist, is an echo of this life incident in the life of the Buddha. We're acting like the Buddha. We're going in front of an image of the Buddha, thinking we're in front of the Buddha himself. And we are placing our hands together and saying, from now until enlightenment is reached, I take refuge in the Buddha, the transcendent conqueror, the greatest of all human beings. And then we say, I take refuge in the Dharma, which is peace. and freedom, the greatest of all that is free from attachment. And I take refuge in those who are beyond turning back, the greatest of all communities. Master of this ceremony, please accept me as a follower of the Buddha and a holder of these three refuges, the Buddha, his teaching, and the Sangha or community. And that's what the ceremony of refuge taking is about. We take refuge. The word refuge comes from the idea that we're stuck in this world that the Buddha called samsara, or cyclic existence, or cyclic existence. We're stuck in this world of cyclic existence, and we want to work our way out of it. And to take our path out of it, we need the Buddha, as the protection of the Buddha, we need the protection of the Buddha's teachings, and we need the protection of our community or Sangha. And so we take refuge in those three things, thinking that they will help to lead us out of samsara on our journey. So people ask me frequently, how do I know when I am ready to take refuge? Well, the good news is we don't have a test. You don't have to take a test to show that you are ready for refuge. His Holiness the 17th Karmapa, when he gave a refuge ceremony a number of years ago in upstate New York, said a person can take refuge. They don't even need a ceremony. They can take it on their own if they want to, by saying the Buddha is my teacher, the Dharma is my path, and the Sangha is my community. But he said the ceremony serves as a way of making a promise to yourself that you will keep and hold the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha as your refuge. And so technically, according to the Karmapa, a ceremony is unnecessary, there is benefit in taking such a promise and making such a promise in front of a consecrated image with a relic of the Buddha inside, which is what we do. And so I tell people, when you feel that you are ready, when you feel that you are ready to say the Buddha is my teacher, when you're ready to say the Dharma is my path, when you're ready to say the Sangha, they're my community, then you're ready to take refuge. That is the consequences of taking refuge are that everything you do after that helps you to achieve your awakened path. And so every good thing that you do before you take refuge is virtue for your mind. But everything you do after you take refuge that is virtuous increases the virtue and increases the impact of what you do. So there you go. Did that answer your question sufficiently? Did I leave anything out? Okay. All right. Yeah. And you can go online and sign up to attend the ceremony, or if you just don't have the means to get online, just show up. Center for Pragmatic Buddhism, next Saturday, 10 a.m. And next Saturday, 10 a.m., Center for Pragmatic Buddhism, 1225 Dublin Road in Grandview. Sorry? Oh, is it two Saturdays from now? I thought the 22nd. Oh, that's right. It is two Saturdays from now. It's 29th. That's right. Yeah. Yeah, 29th. Think of it as a good way to spend your leap day. Leap day only comes every 4 years, so it's a good way to spend it. Okay, there's time for one more, if there's one more question. Okay, then we'll do a short period of sitting meditation. We'll meditate quietly for about 3 or 4 minutes. It's a good way to end the program for today. Placing your body in the posture of meditation. You can practice what are called the three excellent virtues. Excellent at the beginning, you say, it has to do with your motivation, and you make the motivation. I will do this practice for the benefit of myself and others so that we can all someday become Buddhas. Excellent in the middle means that you do your best to practice the technique of following the breath and returning your attention when your attention wanders. And excellent at the end will come when we recite our dedication at the end of the practice. So we'll practice with these excellences in mind. This concludes our meditation for today. Once again, I'm really happy that you brought yourself and your good motivation here today to be with us. And thank you for bringing your sincere intention to benefit beings to this space. And I want to invite all of you to come back again. We'll be here next week. And to bring your goodness into your daily lives by thinking and reflecting about your Buddha nature and thinking and reflecting about the aspiration to bring it to fruition for the benefit of yourself and others. I gave a talk one time, and I compared, I used the traditional Buddhist teaching that knowing we have a Buddha nature is like holding a precious jewel and recognizing its value. So we all have value, and we all have intrinsic goodness and value because we have all have Buddha nature. So no matter how difficult life may seem, we have the potential to become Buddhas right there as part of our minds in life. So we'll practice excellent at the conclusion by reciting the dedication of merit prayer. There are two of them, and we'll recite them in English, starting with the words, by this merit. By this merit, may all attain omniscience. May it defeat the enemy, wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death. From the ocean of samsara, may I free all beings. The courageous Manjushri, who knows everything as it is, Samantabhadra, who also knows in the same way, and all the bodhisattvas, that I may follow in their path, I completely dedicate all this virtue. Okay, thanks everyone.
Thank you for joining us for this week's Dharma Talk. We hope you enjoyed the podcast. If you did, please subscribe, rate, and review it on iTunes. To learn more about the Columbus Karma Teksum Choling or to donate to support our Dharma Talk series, please visit our website at columbusktc.org. The opening and closing music for the podcast is Tibetan Flute Song by Tamding Arts at tamdingarts.com. Please join us again next week for another Dharma Talk.